War Eagle, fly down the field. It's time for the SAFTAcast. I'm your host, Scott C. The C is actually part of my name. It really is. It's Scott C, not just Scott. But anyway, I digress. Welcome to the SAFTAcast. I'm your host, Scott C. So much to talk about. Let me just dive right in with the latest news from the Sundress Academy for the Arts of a couple upcoming events that you should be aware of that I want to tell you about right now. You know, booze and literature have had this long intertwined history with one another, and this July, the Sundress Academy for the Arts is going to celebrate that connection. On July 25th, from 4 to 7 p.m. at Firefly Farms in Knoxville, Tennessee, the home of the Sundress Academy for the Arts, join poet and craft bartender Sam Slaughter and explore this fascinating connection. This is a hands-on workshop event. Not only will you read about a few famous literary cocktails from the likes of Anne Sexton and Ernest Hemingway, but you will learn how to make them. Indeed you will, and who knows, you might pick up a trick or two to try some of your own creations at home as you develop that spiritual connection between the booze and the muse. Tickets are available for this event. You can get them by going to sundresspublications.com, clicking on store. That is Writing Booze, a workshop and cocktail class with Sam Slaughter. Check that out, July 25th from 4 to 7 p.m. As I just mentioned, I will repeat for you. To get your tickets today at sundresspublications.com, click on the store. The next day, it's been a while since we've talked about the SAFTA reading series, but, you know, let's talk about it right now, because the next day, Sunday, July 26th at 3 p.m. at the Birdhouse in downtown Knoxville, it's a very special reading series event. Three, count them, three former SAFTA staff members are leaving to go off and get their advanced college degrees. They're leaving the safe haven that is Knoxville and going off into the world, but not before they give one last reading. Oh no. Luke Marinick, Stephanie Lee Phillips, and former SAFTAcast guest Chris Petrocelli will be reading and saying their goodbyes as they head off to Ohio, Mississippi, and Alaska, respectively. See them before they have a bon voyage, my friends. Check this out. You do not want to miss this. This is going to be a beautiful reading. It breaks my heart that I am not able to attend it. So please, listeners, attend it on my behalf and say goodbye and perhaps even hello to some awesome people. That is Sunday, July 26th at 3 p.m., as I said, at the Birdhouse in downtown Knoxville, Tennessee. For information on that, as well as any upcoming events beyond this, you can find Sundress Publications on Facebook. It is one of the fastest and easiest ways to find out what's a-happening there. Just search out Sundress Publications on Facebook. Search out Firefly Farms on Facebook. You will find it as well. Now on to today's show. It is a fun one. We have a wonderful guest on the program today. Amora Cuey is with us, and he is a former sports editor and journalist, and he is turned teacher and poet. He is here with us today to talk about sports, but it's not just about sports. Oh, no, no. We get into some other topics there and discuss growing up in Alabama, many, many more things. It's a fascinating interview. It was a great joy to talk to Amorik. And yeah, I think you're going to like this one. In fact, I don't think you're going to like it. I know you're going to like it. And don't forget that his latest collection, Ha 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 Thump, is available very soon. Pre-orders, I'm telling you, they're flying in. I have an inside knowledge on this. The pre-orders are flying in. You can get his latest collection, Ha 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 Thump, available very soon from Sundress Publications. Reserve your copy of this, and I am not kidding about this, his highly anticipated book at sundresspublications.com and click on store. And if my voice hasn't enticed you to do that, I'm sure Amorix will. But first, let's hear the theme song. Amorik.
Hey, Scott.
Hey, how you doing, man?
I'm doing all right. How about you?
I'm doing pretty good, pretty good. It's good to have you on the program, finally.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm excited to talk to you guys.
Well, you know, we appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule. You know?
Yeah, busy enough.
Busy enough indeed. It's the summertime. Well, let's get it started then. I always start off our interviews with the burning question that is on everyone's mind. What is on your refrigerator door right now?
We have lots of magnets from places we've visited over the years. We have the little ticket that they print out at the orthodontist to tell you when your kid's next appointment is. There's a couple of those. Yeah, and we have a magnet that says hippies use side door, which is my favorite magnet.
I got to ask, what's the meaning or significance of that one?
Well, I mean, I just think it's funny because it's so, you know, insulting. I think it's either a replica of a real sign or an imagined sign from the 60s when, I guess, small towns didn't want hippies coming in their front doors. And I always tell people that my parents were hippies, which is sort of true. I feel like I have hippie heritage, and so take back the front door for us.
You sort of think they were hippies. What do you mean?
Well, I would say it's half true in that my father was 100% for sure a hippie. I mean, he hitchhiked to California a couple times. He was in San Francisco during the Summer of Love after having hitchhiked there with a buddy. He ran the underground newspaper at Western Michigan University where he was in college. I think the first time he picked up my mother for a date, he was wearing, you know, like a bathrobe. That was his outfit for the evening. So, and he had long hair, and he lived in the coolest house in Kalamazoo, or a cool house in Kalamazoo where the hippies all hung out. I know that when Allen Ginsberg came and did a reading in Kalamazoo, after the reading, it was my dad's house that he went to hang out at. So, and then my mom was, she was kind of counterculture, but she categorically denies that she was ever a full-fledged hippie. She said the hippies became their own culture themselves, and she did never belong to that.
I wonder how they got together then. Like, what could have drawn two people like that together?
I mean, they met in college. They met at Western Michigan. And I think my mother was, she grew up in, I mean, they both grew up in sort of Midwestern Kalamazoo, Michigan suburbs. And so they have similar backgrounds, and I think they were both looking to get away from that. So I think that's probably what drew them together.
Yeah, that'll do it. You know, you're rebelling not necessarily against the system, but you're both of your pasts.
Right, exactly. Yeah, no coincidence. Like, they were, after they got married and had me and my brother, they moved about 800 miles from home. So I think they were trying to escape, not escape, but as in there had anything to run away from, but just trying to start fresh, find a new way for themselves. And it was involved being very far from their parents.
Change of scenery will do it.
Sure, for sure.
Where did they wind up?
I grew up in a small town outside Birmingham, Alabama, about 20 minutes from Birmingham, 20 miles from Birmingham, Alabama. A small town called Trussville.
I know Alabama, but no, I've not heard of Trussville.
Yeah, it's not. There's no real reason for you to have it. It's not nearly as small as it was when I was there, because now sort of the urban sprawl has reached all the way from Birmingham, and now there's a Target and a huge strip mall and lots of restaurants, and there was none of that when I was there. I remember about the time I graduated from high school, we got a McDonald's by the interstate, and that was a big deal.
It's like, that's where you take everybody on a Friday night.
Heck yeah. Although, I mean, the thing is, it was a small town, but it was within easy driving distance of the city. Birmingham suburbs stretched out. So there were movie theaters and stuff that we could go to. They just weren't in our town.
Kind of like a little, almost like a little suburban residential area. And then you had to go out to go to other places. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. A little isolated from the town in that you could, from the Birmingham and the Birmingham suburbs, but most of the people who lived there probably worked in Birmingham. I mean, it was definitely a commuter kind of small town.
Just enough to keep you interested, enough to keep you there, and you didn't have to deal with the big life of the Pittsburgh of the South.
Exactly. I think that the sign as you entered town, the city limits sign said, big city convenience, small town hospitality, which I guess, that's exactly what they were going for.
Was that accurate? Did they have small town hospitality there?
You know, is small town hospitality a real thing? I guess all places are hospitable to some extent. And sure, I mean, it was a great place to grow up, but I think it had all the issues of being in a small town, a rural small town, that both good and bad. You know, I think that it was pretty homogenous, and it was pretty white, it was pretty middle class, and so, you know, in that sense, was it welcoming to everybody? No, probably not. But if you were part of the culture there, then it was a good place to grow up and a good place to live.
But you ended up kind of then doing what your parents did. You kind of moved a completely different direction, though, away from Alabama.
As it turned out, yeah, sort of coincidence. I don't. I'll leave it to my own kids to interpret why I might have done it. But after college, I moved to Tallahassee, Florida, and then I was living there when I got married, and we went to Lexington and Louisville, Kentucky, for a while my wife did her PhD, and then the academic job market brought her to Grand Rapids, Michigan, and where she got a job at Grand Valley State, and I was a journalist at the time. And I got a job with the newspaper here. So it was the job market that brought us back to Michigan. We didn't sort of set out to go anywhere in particular. We were just sort of wide open to what the possibilities were when she went on the job market. And as you know, the academic job market can take you anywhere.
Yeah, you gotta have that freedom when you get your PhD. You gotta have a little bit of freedom to basically say, I'm going wherever it is.
Exactly. Otherwise, you get stuck in really poor situations, to me, you know, where you're adjuncting at four schools and doing online grading the rest of your time. And it is definitely key to have that flexibility.
I once heard somebody that was talking about like how to get on the job market. They said, okay, money, the college and coworkers, and location. Pick two, because that's all you're going to get.
Right. And these days, it might even be just pick one.
Go to the place that has health insurance.
Right, exactly. Exactly. I feel lucky to have a job that, you know, has... I mean, actually, I feel like I have all three, but I just sort of... It was a combination of being in the right place at the right time and just luck, I guess.
My mother's only advice to me when I graduated was, get health insurance. That's more valuable than a paycheck now.
That is for sure true, although... Now it eats up more and more of the paycheck that used to be, you know, included, and now it's less and less included.
True, but then there's that day where you actually need it, and you're like, thank you.
For sure. I mean, with kids, and, you know, they have regular doctor visits, and my kid, they both need orthodonture, and the dental insurance is covering not all of that, but a part of it. So we're grateful all the time. Like, thank goodness we have health insurance.
I thank God that my parents had dental insurance for me.
Yeah, I grew up without dental insurance, without health insurance. Probably never went to a dentist until I was 12 or 13. But luckily, I also grew up eating pretty healthy, so my teeth were okay. I mean, I have some fillings, but it could have been much worse. My teeth are a little crooked, but it could have been much worse for sure.
Could have been like me. You know, a combination of bad genetics and just whatever and... Yeah, I don't want to know how many yachts I've bought for dentists over the years.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, my daughter, the last day of, I think it was third grade, she fell off of her scooter and broke her front tooth in half, and it was an adult tooth, unfortunately. You know, we were able to get it, still not fully fixed, but it'll be fully fixed. They got a cap put on it later that same day, so it wasn't that noticeable. I think if that had happened to me when I was 8, I would have had half a tooth for years.
And a cool story you could have made up for it, too.
Yeah, I know. I have to sort of make the story cooler than it actually was. Because, I don't know, just falling off your scooter on the way home is not that exciting.
Might help you get a good interview or something if you're doing journalism. You're like, you know how I got this tooth?
Exactly. The last guy who said no to me.
Exactly. What type of journalism were you in?
Most of my career was in sports journalism, and I was mostly an editor. I did some reporting for a year in Elizabethtown, Kentucky. I covered healthcare and county government, but most of the time I was an editor at a copy desk, either news desk or sports desk, mostly sports desk. And my last journalism job was assistant sports editor at the Grand Rapids Press here in Michigan.
When it comes to sports, what were your favorite ones to cover? I mean, being a Southern boy, I would think football would be like the religion.
For sure. And I was on the sports desk in Tallahassee, Florida, where Florida State football was king, and I didn't do much writing about it, a little bit, but mostly what I did there was edit, design, layout pages and design, write headlines, but football Saturdays and football Friday nights for high school football, those were the big nights. That was what we looked forward to sort of all year. It was just this big, crazy rush to get deadline, to get all this copy in, and the next day you had this 16 or 24-page section that you put all this effort into, and you'd go to restaurant in the morning and people would be reading your work, and it was pretty exciting. So yeah, college football was always great. When I was in Lexington, Kentucky, I was on the sports desk there for a while, and horse racing, I got to be part of the Derby coverage, and that was always fun. You know, it wasn't something that I cared about before I got there, but I learned to enjoy it a lot while I was there.
When you were in Florida, which did you prefer to own, high school or college football, covering and working on those?
College football, probably a bigger deal. I mean, high school football was fun, but it didn't have the sort of universal appeal. Florida State football was the biggest thing that our paper did, and it was the thing that everyone who read the paper cared about, or just about everyone who read the paper cared about. So that felt important. You know, it felt like you were doing something that was going to reach a lot of people.
And high school is more divisive because of the local rivalries. And
like, you know, I care about the high school where I go or my kids go, and I may care about their rivals, but then I don't care about the high school across town, right? So that people aren't as invested universally in everything you write. They care about the story that's about their school, but not the other three. But Florida State football, and you're in Tallahassee, that just rules everything, and everybody knows. And everybody, even if you profess to hate it, you still sort of follow it and read it.
Well, being in Tallahassee, then, it must have been a little bit difficult for you. You know, if you had to hide your allegiances, you're from Birmingham. That's Auburn country.
Yes, I'm an Auburn fan for sure. And I was, at the time, sort of a Florida State fan. I did 3 semesters of grad school there, although I didn't finish a degree. So I'm generally a Florida State fan, but Auburn was always first in my heart. And it was all right. I didn't mind.
Did you have to keep it hidden while you were in Florida State?
I would say not really. I wasn't. I mean, as a journalist, you sort of keep – you're not much of a fan anyhow. That's one of the things – I learned how to be sort of more neutral there, and I wasn't – I was a fan but not rabid. It wasn't about keeping it hidden. It was more about, like, the passion part of it seemed silly because I was looking at it as a neutral observer. So I'm like, all right, well, I'll root for this team, and I'll be happy if they win. But the sort of diehard, live and breathe the team, bleed garnet and gold, that wasn't ever really me.
When you left sports journalism, did the love rekindle for Auburn?
It actually did. I would say that once I was no longer a sports journalist, I'm sort of free to root harder. And so, yeah, I mean, Auburn football is my – I follow Auburn football pretty carefully. I feel like a bit of a hypocrite with college football because it's such an enormous money-sucking thing. It's like an institution, an industrial – college football industrial complex or something. And I feel like as a teacher and as someone who values education, I mean, like, I don't know, a thinking, rational human being, I shouldn't be supporting this massive thing that claims to be tied to academic institutions for no particular reason anymore. But I can't help but I still like watching the team.
I wondered last fall, I said, there was an article, I think, on the Onion's AV Club about, and for all logical, rational reasons, I should hate watching you. I should despise you. Why can't I give you up? And I wonder that myself on all intellectual levels. There is absolutely no reason I should like football anymore. Just,
right.
I don't know what keeps me watching.
Yeah, I feel the same way. I think there's, you know, we know that it is devastating to the bodies of the participants. We know that it sucks up time and resources and energy that could be better spent elsewhere. I'm not like a person who thinks, oh, you know, sports are a waste of time or even team sports are a waste of time. But I see that football is too big. It's too insular. The NFL is all about, you know, protect the shield, make sure that nothing tarnishes the image of the league. And of course, the league image is tarnished all the time, and yet we don't care, right? On Sundays, we'll stop talking about Ray Rice punching his fiance in the face, and we'll watch whoever's banging into each other on the field. And the game has some combination of physicality and intellectualism because there's strategy to it, and it's a complex game with a lot of moving parts, which is pretty interesting to watch. And you get to watch these people do things that we know we could not do. I mean, I can go out and throw a football, right? But I can't throw it as fast or as far. It's just different when they do it. There's a sense of, like, these people have achieved some level of physicality. And I think it's not just watching the Women's World Cup, but it's one of the same, like, what these women do with the soccer ball, I could never, ever do, you know? And I watch them, peak athletes perform at their highest level. You think they're doing something that I could go out and imitate that, but I could never achieve that. And so I think there's something in football, because they're so big and fast and strong, there's a lot of that to it. You can see, oh, these people have reached some new level of humanity almost. most in terms of their athleticism, their strength, and speed.
David Foster Wallace talks about it in his essay, How Tracy Austin Broke My Heart, about the concept, the Greek concept of techne, and how we watch these moments and they're almost like we're looking at gods.
Right. Yeah, I mean, he talks about that in the Roger Federer's religion piece, too. I mean, I think almost, it's like almost epiphanic. Like, you see this moment where the person disappears and all that exists is the will to hit that tennis ball or to catch that pass or to whatever achievement. Like, I don't know. It's, yeah, I think David Foster Wallace's essays on that are really spot on in terms of what we admire about it, what we're drawn to.
I mean, I'm not a big fan of basketball. I openly admit that. It's just not my thing. But I can still watch Michael Jordan for those 2 seconds where he hangs in the air and I'm looking at the defiance of gravity.
Right, and the speed with which they do things and the level of the heights to which they soar, like metaphorically and in basketball space quite literally, yeah, there's something about that that I think that attracts people. And that's one of the reasons I think that we're drawn to sports. And also sports, for a lot of people, I mean, it's a chance to be completely 100 invested in something that you can then quickly distance yourself from if you fail. Like, how often in life do you completely invest yourself in something that could go either way? It's 50-50 or whatever the odds are in a given game. And in life, that's hard because if you lose it, you could really be hurt. But in sports, the damage is fairly minimal. I mean, it can hurt when your team loses. And I remember being a kid and, like, your team loses and you're really upset. But if you're a fan, you sort of learn to get over that pretty quickly. Most of us do. So you get the sense of being completely committed to hoping for something. And then if it doesn't work out, you can move on fairly quickly after that.
Unless you're like me, in which case you don't remember what winning looks like for your team.
Who are your teams?
The Buffalo Bills.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm really sorry.
Yeah, it's sad.
I have some friends from Buffalo, and they are, yes, it's a sad thing.
I long ago gave up.
Yeah, every year. This is the year, but now they don't even say that anymore, do they?
No, every year we have players come in that are like, I'm going to change things here. We're going to have a great season. You know, I'm going to help win. And I'm like, no, we've heard this before.
Yeah.
You haven't had 6 head coaches in 7 years. We have.
Right. I think they still need a quarterback.
Yeah, that's the big fight right now. But Rex Ryan at least is proving entertaining right now for us. We're like,
It's true. He could be entertaining. And, you know, sometimes entertaining can be, at least it can hold your attention through a season.
And then college-wise, I'm a firm believer in the idea that you shouldn't root for a college team you have no connection to.
Okay.
So I root for my wife's college, and I'm sorry, we're going to SEC again. I have to be an LSU fan, or else I'm kicked out of the family.
Ah, the other Tigers, Tigers.
Ooh, really? I know. That could have been my opening question. Is it Go Tigers or Go Tigers?
Yeah, GEAUX, exactly.
Exactly. And then I have to go with my alma mater, the Southern Miss Golden Eagles, who just won their first home game in 3 years this past season.
All right.
I know failure pretty well.
I don't mind other SEC fans because I live in Michigan, so I'm not surrounded by them. I think that, you know, someone being an LSU fan or a Bama fan or whatever would really bug me if I lived in the South and had to deal with it constantly. But up here, I feel a kinship. We root for the SEC instead of the Big Ten. I was at, I don't know, some parking lot. I think taking my son to a soccer game, some random parking lot in Zeeland, Michigan, and somebody drove by with an LSU bumper sticker and yelled, "Go Tigers!" because I was wearing an Auburn shirt. And he meant the other Tigers, the GEAUX Tigers.
So there's a little bit of kinship there nonetheless. It's like, hey, we're both transplants.
Exactly. And we know what football's really like, not these Big Ten chumps.
Yeah, well, my wife and I started dating. She said, "You got to understand, Scott, the SEC, we play football and do gymnastics." And I said, "Yeah, but how many of your teams make it to the Final Four or the Sweet 16? Because I'm from Big East country, Syracuse country.
Right. Yeah, we have Kentucky for that.
That's true, Kentucky and... we also have lacrosse, though.
Yes. Lacrosse is pretty big in Michigan high school. Like, there's a lot of high schools around here that have it, too. And it's not a sport I grew up with at all.
I tell students sometimes, I'm like, you know who the best college teams are in ice hockey? And they're like, who? And I'm like, the Ivy League.
Right.
Cornell, RIT, these are the best of the hockey teams.
Right, so, exactly.
I don't know how this...
They're like, hockey, is that a sport?
Oh, wait, we can actually beat people up and have brains? Cool.
Right. Although, I don't know, I had a student once who was, he played on the club hockey team here at Grand Valley, and he had so many concussions that he had to quit playing. Oh. See, one of those guys who'd stick his head in the middle of the action every time, and it took his toll.
I will never dump on hockey players. I recognize how brutal it is.
For sure. It is a tough sport, and they do what other athletes do, only they do it on skates. And like, if you've ever tried, if you're not a skater, just trying to get on skates is challenge enough.
Well, actually, you're with Sundress Publications now, and its founder, Erin Elizabeth Smith, was a goalie, a hockey goalie, and led the league.
I did not know that.
Yeah, and she led the league in penalty minutes.
As a goalie?
As a goalie.
I like it. That's some spunk right there.
She was, I've heard the stories of her as a hockey goalie. Yeah. Just don't get near the crease when she's there.
I like it. Are you a hockey fan or are you a Sabres fan?
I grew up in a hockey town with the Binghamton Whalers, then they became the Rangers, and now they're the Senators. And I always feel guilty because I should love hockey, but it's kind of like on my radar and that's it.
Well, you can't be a fan of everything. There's just not enough time, right? And it's to be a fan of something requires a certain investment of like, checking the standings and following the team and knowing who the players are, because otherwise, you just can't do everything.
Beyond football, are there other sports that you really dig watching, that you're a fan of?
Well, I like baseball. Baseball was my sport growing up. It's the sport I played as a kid until I was, 16 or 17, when I finally stopped, gave up the dream. Although I did try to walk onto my college baseball team, and they were kind enough not to laugh outright, but I did not make it. And I still play slow pitch softball. My daughter calls old man softball. So baseball, my kids both play baseball. My daughter plays softball, and I coached her team this year. That's always, like, if you ask me what my favorite sport is, in my heart, I always think I go back to baseball. I also have become a soccer fan because my kids have both played soccer. My son still plays. He's on a travel team here. And I started out just watching, you watch the games because your kid's playing, and then in the movie Raising Arizona, he talks about finding himself driving by convenience stores that aren't on the way home, and I found myself watching soccer games that did not involve my children, and so now I've become kind of a soccer fan.
And you mentioned you are also you got into horse racing because of living in Kentucky. Has that stayed with you?
Not much, because really, it's hard. That's a hard sport to follow unless you're in a place where they show it regularly. It's not on TV all the time. I follow the Triple Crown races. I sort of read about it leading up to the Derby to see who the favorites are. I watched the Triple Crown races, and I was excited this year to have a Triple Crown winner. I thought that was pretty cool to have that happen in my adult lifetime. But no, I don't watch follow anymore. I mean, part of the following it was the ability to go to Keeneland in Lexington or to the Downs, Churchill Downs in Louisville, and like actually watch it happen. It's a fun sport to watch live, and you can gamble fairly cheaply because you can just put down a $2 or $4 bet every race and have invested interest, but not like it's costing you tons of money.
Like going to a casino and playing the cheap slots, or going in and saying, I'm only going to spend $20. If I lose it, I lose it.
Right. Which I found is a good way to guarantee that you will lose it. Pretty much a sure thing. I mean, some people manage to pull that, I turned my $20 into $60, but most people, if you go in intending to lose $20, you will lose $20. I've never really cared all that much for most casino games except for poker. I like poker. I fancy myself an okay poker player, but slots, I feel like it's just spending money. I don't get enough visceral satisfaction from the spinning of the wheel or the fake spin, the electronic version of spinning the wheel.
Yeah, I don't really care anymore. They've become these computerized games now. They're basically like handheld smartphone versions of slot machines. There's no more wheels or anything. Take some of the fun out. But you mentioned poker. What type of poker? Texas Hold'em or other variants?
I like Hold'em because it's the popular game of the day, or at least it has been for the past 10 or 12 years. But, I grew up playing dealers. Not grew up, but came of age as a poker player playing Dealer's Choice. So I like all sorts of... I have these friends that I get together with once a year from high school and college, and we play, spend the weekend together in some different city every year, and basically what we do is play cards most of the time. usually have some hold them in there, but we mostly play Dealer's Choice. And then I don't have a regular card game right now, but over the years I've had regular card games. Sometimes it's hold them, sometimes it's Dealer's Choice. And I like all of it. I like playing.
What's the appeal of poker if it's not money, let's say? If you're just playing for, you know, pennies, basically, or just playing the chips, what's the appeal of poker to you?
Well, I do feel like it has to be for money. The stakes have to matter. Like, if you're just playing for chips, eventually someone will lose patience and not care. And it doesn't work if you don't care if you lose. You have to care, right? Because you can't bluff anybody. If someone doesn't care if they lose, then they don't. Like, if it's just, I'm tired of playing, I'm just going to put all my chips in there. There's no game then. Because then it's just like, I will deal out the cards and turn them over and see who has the best. Might as well be playing war. So it's that combination of it has to hurt a little bit to lose. And not that I play for high stakes at all, certainly not, because I feel like that's a way to really hurt, right? But even if you play for, like, where a session is like $30 or $40, I don't want to lose $30 or $40. I can. And so if I lose $30 or whatever, it's going to hurt a little bit. So I try not to. I like the strategy of it, the reading people. I'm pretty good at, and I grew up in a card-playing family, so I'm pretty good with cards, with, you know, knowing, counting cards and knowing what's available in a deck, and I'm pretty good at reading people's, I don't know if I'm pretty good at it. I feel like in most crowds I can be an above-average player. So I enjoy the sort of mental challenge of its combination of math and psychology, which I find really fascinating.
The human interaction and being able
exactly.
to read people.
And it's fun. I mean, it should be fun. Like, playing at a casino with strangers, that's not really fun. That's, you know, you put your head down and sort of don't interact too much. But if you're playing with friends at a table, it should be a fun, open experience. And I always like that.
It's camaraderie. You should be able to make fun of each other.
Exactly.
You know, demand that somebody go get chips, you know.
Exactly.
You lost, you go get the pretzels.
Exactly. That's right. And the Dealer's Choice aesthetic is part of that too, right? I don't like to play all games with 100 wild cards and crazy rules, but some of that, it keeps it fun and light, right? But at the same time, the same principles of like reading the odds and knowing what the situation is apply. And so I always enjoy that.
There's some strategy involved then.
For sure. And I like anything that makes me focus on process over outcome. And, like, in poker, you can make all the right plays and lose terribly because somebody else made terrible plays and got better cards, right? And you have to focus on, did I make the right decision? Did I make the right decision? And I like that sort of the self-analysis and the self-discipline that forces on you. And, like, you can win and make a bad decision, and in the long run, that you will not succeed that way. But I like the way it makes me pay attention to my own decision-making process.
So essentially, after the game's over, you go home, let's say you've lost $30 or so, and you start replaying it essentially in your mind. Where did I make the mistake?
Right. Ideally, you should be doing that sort of all along. Like, okay, I'm losing, but why? I'm telling myself it's because my cards are terrible, but is that really it? Could I be minimizing the damage of these good cards, or the few times when my cards are good, am I winning enough money? So you can sort of constantly be thinking, okay, how is my play? Am I making the right decisions here?
That's something I should probably do, because when I play digital poker, I suck terribly. I just royally suck. I'm up there. It's like it's part of my bane of life, along with Scrabble and pool.
I find mostly when I play poorly at poker, it's because I get bored. And when you get bored, you stop caring about your decisions.
Or you're too drunk at the table. You know.
Well, I normally don't drink very much when I play poker. Because I like playing so much, and I sometimes do, but mostly being drunk at the table is not a recipe for success.
No, you got to keep your mind sharp.
Absolutely. You have to be paying attention.
So, yeah, I'm noticing then a common thread here of football and baseball and poker. All of these games are games where the outcome has luck involved, but it's really about the strategy of the game.
Yeah, I mean, I like thinking about strategy. I like games. I like playing board games. You know, my family, my wife and I play games. We have people over to play games. I like strategy games a lot. I like the exercise it puts my brain through.
You know, baseball's one of those games where you wouldn't think there's a lot of strategy involved. Just hit the damn thing and run.
Right.
But the more I look into it, I'm like, wow, there's actual strategy involved here.
Right. I mean, the guys at the highest level, you know, they know so much about each other's tendencies. And now with video instantly available, I've read about how a pitcher can look at, okay, I want to look at all the 0-2 pitches this bat, like say I'm pitching to Albert Pujols. What does he do on an 0-2 curveball? And you can, on your iPad, call up 50 pitches that where he faced an 0-2 curveball and to see what his tendency is. Or if you're a batter, you go, okay, what does this pitcher throw on his first pitch? And you can watch 50 first pitches in a row. And they go into it knowing these things about each other. And then, of course, you know that I know that I always throw a fastball on the first pitch, so I'm going to throw a changeup. But you know that I know that you know. And so I think there is a lot of cat and mouse to it.
It sounds almost like trying to read someone's tell in poker.
Right. I think there is something to that, right? I think the Princess Bride scene with the poison, the Iocane powder.
Never thought about that involved in there. Though there is a famous SportsCenter clip where they crammed in as many Princess Bride references as they could into 40 minutes.
Oh, that's pretty funny. I don't think I've seen that.
It's absolutely brilliant. I forget what football... I think it was during football season, and they just try to cram as many movie references into their commentary as possible to see if anybody would catch it.
Very nice.
You know, like somebody does an amazing play, and I think the announcer's like, there will be no survivors in this.
Inconceivable.
Bill Belichick keeps using that word, but I don't think it means what he thinks it means.
Very nice. Yeah, that's good. I'll have to see if I can dig that up somewhere. I'm sure it's on YouTube or something.
It is. It's a wonderful little moment to see them having fun with it. But yeah, it's very much like trying to figure out the tell and everything. When you're watching baseball, do you have a certain team that you're focused on?
I have always been a Dodgers fan. I think because the first World Series I ever watched was, and the first postseason I ever really watched was within 77 and 78 when the Dodgers were playing the Yankees and the Reggie Jackson era Yankees. And I sensed instantly, even at that young age, that the Yankees were evil. And so it was the Dodgers. And then I was a Dodgers fan ever since then.
I thought you were going to say the Oral Hershiser years there where they were succeeding with Lasorda. Well, that was,
yeah, well, that was like, so in the 70s, the late 70s, the Dodgers came up on the short end against the Yankees. And then in 81, they won, and that was Steve Garvey and Davey Lopes and Ron Say and Bill Russell. And then they were good again in the late 80s with the Oral Hershiser years, which was another highlight. And then really they haven't been that good since then, which is disappointing.
It seems like they've come up just short the last few years or so. Like they have a chance, and then it slips away.
Right. Well, they keep running into the Cardinals in the playoffs. And for some reason, the Cardinals seem to have the Dodgers number in the postseason.
Are the Cardinals now becoming like the Yankees of the NL?
Well, apparently they're cheating, too. Did you see the story about they may have hacked into the Astros intranet and read their scouting reports and stuff?
No, I did not hear about this.
Yeah, so I think a former Astros employee now worked for the Cardinals, and they didn't disable his account, so he was still able to log in. He still knew the password or something.
And maybe they're becoming the Patriots of the NL.
Yeah, exactly. I think they're, I mean, what rubs, for a long time, what you hear about the Cardinals is, oh, they do it the right way, you know, and they're the heart of America, the Midwest team, and I think that some people have felt like there's a little smugness in that. We're the hard-working, blue-collar Midwest team, as opposed to you fancy coast teams like the Dodgers and Red Sox and Yankees. Like, I don't know. It seems a little... Every stereotype has its roots in reality, but it's also sort of made up. It's a mythology that you tell about yourself. And so I think people are reacting a little bit these days against that Cardinals mythology of being old-school baseball.
Innocent farm boys.
Exactly, right.
And the Yankees are America's team.
Yeah, I don't know. Everyone either loves them or hates them, I think.
Yeah, they're very divisive, I find.
Yes. Are you a Yankees fan growing up in New York?
I grew up in Yankee country, but where I was more of a Mets fan because at the time I became conscious of baseball was the magic season for the Mets.
Okay.
You know, and I had the starting lineup, the big names, as one sheet of baseball cards in my collection at the time.
Oh, very nice.
Because I was like, I gotta have Strawberry in there now too. So I gotta, you know, I gotta have the lineup.
Right. So this would be 86.
Around then, 86 to 85 to 87 era.
Right. Very nice. And then, yeah, for the year they beat the Red Sox on the Bill Buckner play.
Mm-hmm. I don't follow baseball all that well, but okay, you throw the name Buckner out there. I know that play. I've seen it. I've watched it.
Right.
I'm aware of that and how he still cannot be mentioned in the town.
Right. What a thing. There's a David Kirby has a poem called The Death of Fred Snodgrass, and it has a line from the San Francisco Chronicle as it's at the beginning of it. Says that it says here in the Chronicle that Fred Snodgrass, who helped to cost the Giants the 1920-something World Series by dropping an easy fly ball, died today at age 82 or something. And then the poem is entirely is, fuck you, Fred Snodgrass, some things we never forget. And I think that Buckner has that too, right? No matter what he does, and no matter how long he lives, when he dies, the first sentence of his obituary will be, who muffed an easy ground ball that helped to cost the Red Sox. Man, that's tough. You have this moment in your 30s that, okay, that's it. My obituary is written.
Especially because the Red Sox have won the World Series since then. So you think maybe, okay, you're forgiven now?
It's not even, I mean, I think he might be forgiven, but not forgotten. Like, that's the thing, right? Maybe people have softened on hating him for it because, yeah, they've won a couple World Series since then. But I don't think they've forgotten for sure.
Definitely not. Sports fans tend to have very long memories.
For sure, we do. Especially about losses, right?
Yes. There was a time when Buffalo could win a game. Oh, yes.
Yes, just not the game. They could win lots of games, just not the one that mattered.
And I forgive them for the first Super Bowl loss. Okay, that's dramatic. You missed a kick. Oh, on a field goal in the last second. Fine. I'm sorry. I know our next guest on the Saftacast is a huge Cowboys fan, but it will always sting, and I will never have love for the Cowboys.
That's fine. I don't love the Cowboys either. They were my favorite team when I was 7 or 8, but that's because they were popular, and they were the only team you could hear anything about because I grew up in Alabama, right? And so the local team there, the closest we had to a local team was the Falcons, and they were terrible, so no one cared about. The NFL was just not a big deal growing up.
The Saints were also paper bag era.
Exactly, right, yep. And so the two teams that could have been local and probably are now the local teams. I think the Saints are the most popular team in Birmingham now. But at the time, why would you be a Saints fan unless you're actually from New Orleans? Because they were just simple. So I was a Cowboys fan for a little while, but I don't like the Cowboys. Unless I happen to have one of their players on my fantasy team. And then
do you do a lot of fantasy games?
I do fantasy football. I've been in the same fantasy football league for about 19 years. A friend and I, my college roommate and I, are co-commissioners of it. We run it online, and we've been doing most of the same players since the beginning. Like I think we're heading into year 19.
It's mostly the same players with the same team names and such.
Yeah, I mean, we've had some people come and go, but yeah, there's a core group of 6 or 8 of us who've been there since the very beginning. I've done other fantasy sports in the past, but right now the only fantasy sport I play is football. And it's really my touchstone to the NFL. I don't have a favorite NFL team, really, so my only rooting interest there is usually my fantasy team.
It's like, I don't care who wins as long as there's good players and good games.
Yeah, exactly. I want to be entertained, and I can watch most any NFL game and find it entertaining for all the reasons we talked about earlier.
Yeah, that's the way I feel. I'm in South Florida, where the only time I'm ever going to see the Bills is if they play Miami in Miami.
Right. Yeah, up here it's the Lions, and you know it's Lions country for sure. And my son is a Lions fan, but I root for the Lions, but only mildly. I don't care all that much.
You root for them in the way that, well, they're the home team,
right? Exactly, and they're one of those teams that disappoints and disappoints. You know, one of the only teams that's never won a Super Bowl.
And they seem like they can half the year, and then at least in the last few seasons, and right. Seems like they can, and then something happens.
Yeah, exactly.
Lose the will to live. Oh, man. No. Anyway, for you then, watching football and games like that, it's about the strategy and also about seeing the physicality of it and knowing I can't do that. So that's amazing to me. For me, I find it's the drama, the story that can happen in the middle of a game.
Right. I mean, I think that is another thing that we like about sports, right, is the narrative with the unpredetermined outcome. I mean, I love reading novels or short stories, but you know that the sort of outcome is predetermined. And part of how you're going to judge the success of the writer is, did they make you believe in the narrative, in the outcome? But with sports, assuming that it's not fixed, and I think in general sports are not fixed, the outcome is not predetermined. Like, the favorites usually win, but they don't always, and you don't know when that time is going to be that they don't. And so you like that narrative with possibility every time.
So even I would say with scripted ones now, like pro wrestling and such, it comes down to what story are you telling, how good is the story, and not just outside of the ring, but the story of the match in the ring.
Right. And it's, I'm not a big pro wrestling guy. I watched it for a while, a couple different times in my life, but I have lots of friends who are pro wrestling fans, and it's the same thing. And the scripting part doesn't matter. They just like the story, watching the story unfold. And they get a lot of the same things that you watch football for. They get the narrative, they get the drama, they get the physicality and the sort of superhuman nature of these people. You know, there's good and evil, there's sides to choose, and I think, so it has all of that stuff.
There's something, I used to watch a lot of boxing also when I was in my teens. It's my sport. And it was beautiful to watch two athletes go at each other in such a way and see the drama unfold in the ring.
Right.
Especially if they didn't hurt each other. It was beautiful to watch, like an Ali fight. Unless he's up against, like, Foreman or Frazier.
Right. Are you still a boxing guy?
Not really. I don't keep up with it, but when I was a teen, I found I had a supernatural skill almost for picking boxing matches as I watched them. Like, all I had to do was just, like, before the match, I'm like, okay, yeah. And I think my prediction record, I started calculating, was around 87% correct.
That's pretty good.
I was like, why didn't I go into a career in that? Oh, yeah.
Yeah. If you could keep it at 87, you actually could make a career at that, except move to Vegas.
Yeah, but, long-term success, probably not going to work with me, so, eh.
Right. So. Yeah, I mean, I'm not a big boxing fan, but being from Grand Rapids, Floyd Mayweather Jr. is from here. And so, especially when I was at the newspaper here, I followed his career pretty carefully, and he's an interesting fighter. I mean, I don't think a very good human being. But
most boxers aren't, I find.
but he's a really fascinating fighter because he's extremely strategic, and he wins because of his smarts and his fitness, and he doesn't do a lot of damage to people, but they can't touch him, and they can't outlast him, and he never wear down, and so that's why he's undefeated as a pro boxer. It's interesting, and then unfortunately he has some unpleasant issues outside of. Outside the ring, which makes it difficult to root for. Because it would be nice to be able to root for him, but he's not a good person.
Yeah, and we come back to that whole thing of, like, the NFL is making it really hard for me to like them anymore,
Exactly.
Are there any sports figures left that we can still believe in, so to speak?
Boy, I wish. I mean, it depends what you mean by believe in, right? I mean, I think...
Well, let me rephrase this, that in the 50s and 60s, we believed in, regardless what you think of the Yankees, the players. We believed in certain ones. They're superhuman. They were idols to be worshipped,
right.
Even though Mickey Mantle was a bit of a drunk or, Billy Martin was an asshole. But there were still the Lou Gehrigs,
right.
The nobility. Is there anybody in modern sports like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's dangerous to pin... During someone's lifetime, is it dangerous, athlete or not, right? Dangerous to pin that kind of label on them. I mean, I think people would have said that about Bill Cosby 20 years ago. And it turns out he's a rapist monster, right? Did Derek Jeter use steroids? I don't know. I kind of wish that I could say, oh, of course not. He's Derek Jeter, but how can I say that? I was such a big fan of Jackie Joyner Kersee. And when she was accused of using steroids, she denied it. I'm like, I watched your press conference and the emphatic way with which she denied it, I kind of believe her. And then I find out, nope, she was lying. And so I don't know. I think it's part of me feels like, okay, I'm just going to watch the game or the event and I'm not going to invest any emotion outside of, like, I like watching you play sports. But then that feels like I'm sort of copping out and taking, there's no accountability. I don't know. I don't know what the answer is. And can I believe in anybody? I mean, I love Clayton Kershaw. I think he's fantastic. If I found out that he used steroids or some sort of HGH or something, I would be really disappointed. But at this point, I'm not sure how surprised I would actually be.
Yeah. The only one that could come to mind for me would be Jerry Rice. But again, how can I say that, really? I don't know.
Right. I mean, he seems like a good guy, and he certainly seems to be noble. He certainly seems that way. But I think there's an, unfortunately, as has been proven over and over again, there's a danger in assigning that kind of humility and sort of like making them into a better person than they may be. But he certainly seems that way. Rice is definitely one that comes to mind.
How did you end up where you are now? Like, and what I mean by that is you started out in sports journalism, you're an editor shifting around three different states. Why did you leave it? How did you wind up as teacher? And
right. Well, so I started immediately after college. I went to grad school at Florida State, and I was going to do an MA in creative writing. Didn't finish and started working at the newspaper right after that. And so it just kind of fell into journalism. I was an English major in college, a political science minor, and had done some internships that let me get the newspaper job. And journalism turned out was a great career for me for a long time, because I think the reason that grad school didn't stick the first time with me is that everything felt delayed. I didn't really know why I was doing it. So there's no short-term gratification. And the newspaper business at the time is all short-term gratification. Every day you go in, you put out a product, and it's done the next morning, and then you start over. And that was a great thing for me for a long time, and I really liked it. And then by the end, oh man, the newspaper business was changing so much. I didn't agree with the decisions that were being made at the paper that I was at, and not so much by the local decisions, by the people at the paper, but by the corporation that owned us. And I felt like I just didn't feel like the people who were on the ground doing the journalism had any power to influence anything anymore. There were layoffs, there were buyouts. It was just, morale was terrible. It felt like I needed to leave. So I was unhappy at the end. I was unhappy in the newspaper business. And I had done my MFA at Western Michigan while working at the newspaper. I was commuting to Kalamazoo and taking a class or two or three, two at a time. Over about 5 years did my MFA. And right as I finished that, the chair of the writing department at Grand Valley gave me a call. It was in August, late July, early August of 1 year. And he said, you know, we have more freshmen this year than we thought we were going to. I've been given permission to hire a visiting professor to teach freshman comp this year. And it's a 3-year contract. So would you like to quit your job and come work for me? And I said, yes. And so I was a visitor for 3 years at the same place where my wife also taught writing. She got a rec comp PhD. Then after 3 years, they had a tenure line opening, and I applied for it and was able to get that job. And so leaving the newspaper business, it just felt like the newspaper business was also leaving me. The job that I had always done basically no longer exists. In a lot of ways, the newspaper business did it to itself, because they were driving the news around in trucks long after the time when that made sense as a way to deliver content, to deliver information. But they still don't know what they're doing in terms of like how to make money off of writing good stories. And so it's about hit counts and generating comments and moderating the horrible comment fields on stories. And that just doesn't interest me. I don't feel like that's journalism. It's not what I liked about the business. There's a lot of good people still in the newspaper business doing the best they can, but I feel like they're hamstrung and they're not able to do the real work as much as they used to be able to.
It also feels to me like this confusion about, like, how do we keep this profitable on the internet? Because my hometown paper is behind a paywall. You get, like, 2 articles for every 30 days for free. But all I have to do is go to the local TV station and look, and I've got the same content. Even the New York Times, most of their articles now, the current stuff, is free to watch, free to read.
So, yeah, it's so hard. I mean, and I think internet advertising doesn't generate anywhere near the amount of revenue that print advertising did. And so, and producing good journalism is expensive. I mean, because it requires a lot of manpower. You can't be posting 6 articles and moderating the comments every day if you want to write good stories, if you want to be developing sources and covering a beat. And so I feel like doing journalism well and being profitable are at odds. They probably always have been at odds, but it used to be that there was enough profit on the other side, on the advertising side of the building, that they could afford the loss that was the journalism side. And now there's just not enough profit on that other. I mean, Netflix pop-up ads don't pay a salary.
Are there good places for journalism on the net that you found? Like, is there still good journalism being written?
Well, sure. I think the New York Times still does, by and large, good journalism. The I don't think New York Times is perfect, but that's my go-to source for most national news. And I feel like a lot of journalism is this sort of quick talking point, clickable stuff. I mean, Slate and Salon, you know, here's a story on the latest topic and here's our take on it. But I feel like there are papers that still have good stories from time to time. I think ESPN.com, even though ESPN is sort of this sort of evil giant of sports journalism, I think there are good people writing good stories there. They funded Bill Simmons' Grantland Project, which I think has some good journalism on it. So, yeah, I think it's still out there. It's not always easy to find, and it's not always in the same place. And sometimes it's stuck between, you know, clickbait headlines. And we've replaced a lot of journalism with commentary, but it's still being done. And I think we're just still sorting it out. It's a transition time for journalism. It's not going to be a short transition, and it's going to be ugly. It's still out there.
It's messy, but it's not dead by any means.
Right. Well, we need it. It's a part of what makes democracy function. Democracy without watchdogs is not democracy. And, you know, there's a reason that governments that fight against transparency, I mean, even the Obama administration, disappointment with Obama is the lack of transparency, the way he's continued that sort of trend that has been going on that Bush really accelerated about lack of transparency from the federal government. Like, let's be more transparent. You know, some of the Republican candidates are governors, like Scott Walker's. He wants to basically destroy the Sunshine Law in Wisconsin. Like, we need watchdogs. We need people with access to these public institutions. It's a vulnerable time for journalism, but I think there's enough people still fighting the fight.
Have you noticed, I've noticed this in the last few years. It seems like, while the administrations may not be as transparent, I've noticed a surge in, you know, fact checkers, Politico, and things like that, of young people really taking the reins of doing the investigation themselves.
Absolutely. And, you know, the more people can do that kind of stuff, the better. You know, the problem, again, is, like, the lack of profitability, right? Which is great that you can be all gung-ho and young and fired up and go do this thing, but can you live a life that way? When you decide to have a family and send your kids to school and save for their college, can you still do that? Is there money in it? Or is that when you quit being a firebrand and go work for PR? You know, it'd be nice if they didn't have to make that transition at some point, but I feel like that's the model we have right now. If you're young and unattached and don't have a lot of expenses, you can sort of do real work, but then when you grow up, quote unquote, and have to support your family, then you know, oh, now I need a real job, and now I'll go work for PR or write, you know, be the communications director for a company, for a politician.
You sell your soul to the other side, you know.
It certainly seems that way. And, you know, that doesn't mean you can't do good, honorable work from the other side either, but it's just not the same thing.
I understand. When I was in radio, I was in freeform college radio, rare thing, but I always said, look, if some major, you know, Citadel Communications or whatever came up and dump truck full of money in front of my house, I'll sell my soul.
Absolutely. I mean, right. It's, you got to take care of yourself and your family first, right? And it's not even necessarily selling your soul. It's just doing something different, right? Mm-hmm. I think you can still be an ethical person if you work for an institution or for a corporation. It's just that some people are, unfortunately.
Yeah, what does selling out really mean in the end?
I guess, you know, it depends on what you're... If you're truly compromising your values, then you're, I guess it's selling out. But, you know, having a job, paying the mortgage doesn't mean necessarily selling out.
True. And coming back to, you know, coming full circle almost here, it's all about health insurance. Get that, you're good.
Exactly. Right. My dad's not a hippie anymore, right?
Nobody is. That died in the 80s with Jerry Garcia making ties.
Right, exactly.
Ben and Jerry suddenly going, we're going to make ice cream. Coming back around, the question that you might help me to be able to answer, what is the appeal of the hippie? Because I see so many young people want to embrace it, and I'm like, you do realize that hippie's a derogatory term, right?
Right. I mean, I think it sort of represents this sort of free-spiritedness, but it's also, I mean, it's kind of a fashion statement. It's kind of way of belonging to some, feeling like you belong to something larger than yourself while still being who you want to be. You know, I don't know. I mean, I think anytime something takes on that recognizable, universally recognizable standing, you know, goth or hippie, it, you do that because it helps you feel like you fit in. You feel like you belong somewhere. And if you're someone who has a hard time with that, doesn't necessarily feel like you fit into the world, it's nice to have, it's comforting to have something that you can go to and say, okay, this is my identity, and people will recognize it, and I will be this person, and other people will be like me.
Conform. Conform.
Exactly. Well, I mean, it is, you know, it's partly conforming, but not conforming necessarily in a, again, not in a sell your soul way, but conforming, like, belonging to something. Being part of something larger than yourself that makes you feel connected to other humans.
So you wear your Auburn sweatshirt and, you know.
Exactly. It's game day, right?
Yeah, exactly. Right. It's game day. I may be 1,500 miles away, but I got the flag out.
Right. People will walk, if you walk by someone on the street and you're wearing your Auburn shirt, you might get a war eagle from somebody. Yeah. Hey, there's a connection. That's what I wanted was a connection.
Or they might give you a baleful glance at you.
Right. Exactly. Or like the guy in the parking lot, you know, tiger bait at me. Tiger bait. Tiger bait.
Yeah. Or, you know, just somebody go, iron bowl.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, that's all you have to do, right back in their face. Like, 2013 iron bowl.
Yeah, exactly.
For those who don't know what we're talking about, look up the clip.
Look up the clip. Hey, Nick, got a second?
It's beautiful. Well, you know, as an LSU fan, I am legally obligated to hate Alabama.
Indeed. That's a pretty hardcore rivalry lately.
It has been, and it's all due to Nick Saban.
Yes, exactly. He did that, for sure. They still hate him here in Michigan, too, because he left Michigan State to go to LSU.
Yeah, almost every year there's a rumor that LSU's head coach, Les Miles, is going to come back to Michigan.
Yes.
Almost every year there's that rumor, but...
Michigan has their man now. They believe in Harbaugh here, at least for the time being.
Yeah, leaving the NFL to go back to college.
Right.
But hey, whatever works, you know, gotta think of the family. There you go. We've hit a lot of stuff here talking here. It seems like we haven't at the same time.
Well, it's all been it's been related somehow. It all ties together.
We're tying it all together. I'm looking over the things we've tied in sports journalism to death, and modern journalism, all types of sports, pretty much, you know. We haven't even touched on the fact that, I know that a lot of your work, and not to get into writing, don't worry, it's not this program, your writing doesn't matter to us, but I know that a lot of your writing is pop culture infused, and that's, you know, always intrigued by people who do that. So what are your current obsessions right now in pop culture? Like, are there any shows that you're really invested in right now that are going on?
Yeah, I don't think I think I'm more of a dabbler than an obsessor. I don't think pop culture obsessions. I don't think I have any right now. I mean, I watch things here and there, but I don't know that there's anything. There's one thing that stands out. I'm like, oh, I'm obsessed. I have to watch every episode of this show. Since I think Breaking Bad was the last show that I was like, okay, I'm watching it. This show came to it a little late, and then caught up to it and watched like the last season in real time. But since then, I haven't had like a show that is appointment TV. There's things I watch, things I like, but I don't know. I'm more of a generalist than a specific obsession kind of person, I think.
Are there long-standing obsessions when it comes to pop culture for you? Are there certain things you keep coming back to?
I come back to, well, I write about some about heavy metal music, and I listened to that sort of hair band music in the 80s and early 90s, and I do keep coming back to that. My friend Todd Koneko and I are working on a chat book about Slash, the guitarist for Guns N' Roses.
Yes.
So I think I come back to the stuff that I was drawn to way back then, you know, in my high school days, in college days.
It's something about high school music never leaves you.
Right. Exactly.
Just recently, Nirvana has started creeping on to classic rock stations. I'm like, no, no, give me 5 more years, please.
Right. Yeah, that's I don't know, classic rock. And yeah, stuff from the early 90s is definitely, it's old now, right? It's been a long time.
20 years, so it's going to make its comeback now, because nostalgia in America works on a 20-year cycle. You know, that's why the hippies were so big in the 80s and then in the 2000s.
Right, so we're a few years from them making another comeback, I guess.
We are, but now we got to wade through the 90s, and a lot of people of my age and similar age don't want to relive it.
Yeah, I don't know. The 90s didn't make much of an impression on me. I don't know. I was in my 20s in the 90s. And, you know, I think in their 20s, at least for me, I was less invested in popular music and stuff. I watched a lot of movies in the 90s. But beyond that, I don't know. I was out of college and doing, you know, thinking about other things than pop culture at that time.
How far away are we from a Pulp Fiction remake?
It can't be that far. I'm really surprised. That movie doesn't seem old to me, but it is very, it's like 20 years now, so.
I mean, we're mining the 80s for all they're worth, but we're going to start mining the 90s soon for films, so.
For sure. Which is weird to me. It makes me feel old.
I dread what we're up against. So, Emmerich, before we let you go here, as we come toward the end of this, you've got a lot of stuff coming up in the pike here. You mentioned working with Todd Kaneko, who I've had the pleasure of meeting, also awesome dude. And you're working on a chapbook with him. What else you got coming down the pike here, out into the public?
Right. Well, my book From Sundress comes out in about 3 weeks. Looks pretty cool. It's called Ha 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 Thump. So that's the next thing, obviously the big thing. I've got the chapbook that Todd and I are working on, which is still in progress. I've got two other manuscripts in circulation, full-length collections, and I'm working on a chapbook about the property, the farm where I grew up, outside Trussville, Alabama. And I've written probably 15 or 16 poems about that farm, and I'm in the process of sort of organizing them into a manuscript, into a chapbook, and then I'll send that out. I've got a couple of the early poems in that series have been published already, and I'm working on sending out the rest and organizing them into manuscripts. So that's, always writing, always work on the next poem, and always work on the next project. It's sort of how I keep going. And that's where I am right now.
While preparing for the inevitable Dodgers failure in August.
Exactly, yep. Give us at least till September before we collapse.
We'll give you till September to collapse this year.
Thank you.
There you go. Because I don't know what their status is right now. I have a few friends who are huge Dodger fans, but I don't know.
Yeah, they're doing okay. They're neck and neck with the Giants. It's a tough division. Tough rivalry.
So for now, they're okay, but we know the outcome of the story. We've heard this one before. So
we have heard this one before many times over the past 25, 30 years.
Before we let you go, though, Emmerich, where can the folks find you online if they want to check you more out and check out your work?
Yeah, well, I've got a website, amorakhuey.net, AMORAKHUEY.net. And I'm always on Twitter, twitter.com. My handle is Amorak, A-M-O-R-A-K.
Cool. And you're on the Book of the Face as well.
I'm also on Facebook, indeed.
Excellent. Well, we will keep folks in the loop there. Looking forward to seeing your collection come out in a few weeks with Sundress. I haven't seen the previews of it yet, but I'm sure it's spectacular.
It's pretty awesome. Mary Ellen Knight did the cover, and it's amazing. It's really cool. I'm super excited about it.
Oh, yeah. I got to see the cover when she released it. I was like, what? That is gorgeous.
It's pretty cool. I really am happy with it. So
we're looking forward to it. Emmerich, it is a pleasure to have you on the program, man.
Thank you so much, Scott. I appreciate your time.
Oh, no, I appreciate yours. Thank you for being here. And definitely take care of awesome things and be awesome, man.
I will. You as well. You as well, sir.
All right. Take care, man.
All right. Bye-bye.
The SAFTAcast is a production of the Sundress Academy for the Arts. For episodes and more, visit SAFTAcast.com. Until we talk again, this is your host, Scott C., signing off.